This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Despite financial markets trading near all-time highs and prevailing bullish sentiment on Wall Street, our guest today sees a potential long-term breakdown for stocks challenging investment strategies that have worked for decades. I'm Andy Gersher, and this is Gains. All right, we're going to bring on Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, always great to have you on the Gains podcast.
Well, Andy, it's always great to join you.
Yes, and we're going to talk about the prospects of a secular bear market here in just a second. But Jim, first, I wanted to get your take on markets as we're trading here at all-time highs.
Just as an interjection here, I'm happy to send the June 10th weekly technical review to anybody who wants to go into a deeper dive into what you and I are about to talk about. All they have to do is send me an email to jimwelshmacro@gmail.com, and I'll get that out to you. All right, to your point.
And again, that's Jim Welsh, W-E-L-S-H.
Macro@gmail.com. Thanks.
There you go.
So the analogy I always like to use is a car engine. Whether it's six or eight cylinder, doesn't matter. The best performance comes when all the cylinders are working together. And the way we can compare that to the stock market, Andy, is historically, when all the major market averages are moving up together and all or the majority of them are making higher highs with the S&P, it's like the cylinders in your engine all operating with the right timing. And what we've seen over the last few months, and especially over the last few weeks and days, is the S&P has made a new all-time high, but the majority of market averages haven't, other than the Qs and the semiconductor index.
And that speaks to today. I mean, Apple was up 7%. NVIDIA's been on a tear, but it is very hyper-focused to a lot of the tech AI trade. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. So if you take a look at the weighting within the S&P 500, the top 10 stocks now comprise about 35% of the index. So the stocks you just mentioned, in addition to Microsoft and a few other ones, are really carrying the weight. The equal weight S&P 500, which gives a 0.2% weighting to every component, if you compare the performance over the last 11, 12 months, the equal weight is underperforming the S&P by more than 11%. That's huge. As I mentioned, the Russell 2000 didn't make a new high. New York Composite didn't. The Value Line Composite actually peaked in March, hit a lower high in May. So the point being is that the car engine for the stock market is the cylinders are not firing together. And that historically is a warning sign, because what it implies is that the internal strength of the market is weaker than it looks on the surface based on the S&P 500. So the last three, 4 days, Andy, the S&P's made higher highs, there have been more stocks down than up. The number of stocks making new 52-week lows has exceeded the number of stocks making highs. So what this means is if a reason to sell materializes, the internal strength of the market just isn't there to kind of absorb the blow. Historically, this is where corrections, 5 to 7% corrections, typically follow this type of setup. So if you get a really good reason, then you can get a much bigger decline. For instance, the advanced decline line did not confirm last week, just like it didn't confirm in January of 2022. But investors were given a really good reason to sell because the Federal Reserve in March embarked, you know, on a very strenuous rate hiking cycle. So the point is here, Andy, is that the internals of the market are weak, but that 35% weighting to those mega cap stocks, until those stocks really start to fade and weaken, we can see this condition persist where the S&P keeps grinding higher, but the overall market does poorly.
With the S&P 500, like you said, even though it's moving higher, it is very concentrated in tech and NVIDIA, AI trade and the likes. What does that tell you about the rest of the market?
Well, one of the things that we've been told for months now is that the market was going to broaden out. And for a little while, that happened in the first couple of months of this year, Andy. But since March, that has not been happening. And one of the premises behind that narrative that the market would broaden out was the idea that we were going to avoid a recession. And as the economy showed additional strength, cyclical stocks would get a bid, small cap stocks would get a bid, and so forth. So the fact that those averages are lagging badly relative to the S&P suggests that something else is going on. And I believe the economy is going to slow materially in the second half of this year, primarily because the labor market, which on the surface looks just like the S&P, you have the S&P making new highs, it's like, woohoo! The jobs report last Friday, 272,000 new jobs, looks terrific. But if you look underneath the surface, and we can go into the details if you would like.
Yeah, actually, that's a key part to all of this is in the details. And so go ahead, break that down for us.
1 month of data in the employment survey, you can't really hang your hat on it because the numbers are fairly volatile, and they do get subsequently revised often. But if you look at trends over a period of 3 to 6 months, and you see a trend persist, then obviously that's a more reliable signal. So last Friday, there's two surveys, the establishment survey, which gives us how many new jobs are created, and the household survey, which gives us the unemployment rate. And in the establishment survey, which gets most of the attention, job growth was 272,000. In the household survey, job growth was a minus 408,000. And this is a pattern that's been persisting since April of last year. So historically, Andy, what has happened, and I've written about this in my monthly letter a number of times, if you look at inflection points in the economy, like late 2007, late 2000, what starts to happen is you get a divergence. The establishment survey keeps telling us, hey, job growth is still looking pretty good. But the household survey shows that job growth is really weakening, if not outright being negative. And so over the last year, the establishment survey says that the annual increase in jobs was 1.8%. The household survey is at a minus 0.2%. And the reason it happens is that if you're an employer, you're trying to hang on to people. So you're kind of slow to let somebody go unless the economy softens materially, and then you don't have a choice. The definition of what counts as a job between the establishment survey and the household survey is different. In the establishment survey, if I'm working one part-time job and I tell the government, you know, I got a second part-time job, they count that as two jobs in their numbers. The household survey has a different definition. It's one job, one person. So typically what happens near the end of a business cycle is businesses start to cut back on hours, which forces employees to get a second part-time job. So that's one of the dynamics that is underlying.
And that's a huge distinction. That's a very important factor.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter most of the time. I mean, when the a period of years, when the economy continues to chug along and grow, the two surveys pretty much mirror each other. It's only at inflection points, coming out of recession, the household survey picks up, because you get more people shifting from part-time jobs to full-time jobs. So the inflection point issue is really important. And the other important fact is the unemployment rate bottomed in April of last year at 3.4%. This past month, it ticked up to 4% after 27 consecutive months below 4%, which is the longest stretch since 1969. But the thing that's important, Andy, is that historically, going back to 1945, whenever there has been a 0.6% increase in the unemployment rate, as we've just seen, from 3.4 to 4, a recession has always followed. So what that implies to me is that the underlying data, much like the market averages under the S&P, are kind of saying, you know what, things aren't as strong as it looks. The same thing that you can do is look at the employment data. The labor market isn't as strong as the job growth numbers are suggesting. It doesn't mean the economy is going to roll over and die immediately. To me, it just implies that we're going to see a gradual slowdown. And as we get in the second half of this year and early next year, I think the unemployment rate is going to increase, more meaningfully. And historically, the Federal Reserve doesn't cut rates because inflation is down. They cut rates because the economy is slowing and sliding into a recession. And I think the one surprise that could develop between now and year end is that the economy, in fact, does show more signs of slowing than most people anticipate right now. And historically, that's when you get declines of 20% or more. So I think, the technical aspects of the market are weakening. I think the underlying factors within the labor market are showing we should be a little bit more cautious. And that combined to me suggests that in the next handful of weeks or so, I think there's a top coming in the market. The big one may wait until later this year, early next year. But near term, the table's being set for at least a 5-7% pullback after probably some additional strength in response to Chair Powell's comments tomorrow.
Well, and that's some of the fundamentals we're talking about. Now let's shift over to the technicals, look at the charts. As I mentioned earlier, we talk S&P 500 when we're talking levels. What are you seeing on the charts, and are they gelling with this weakness that you're seeing on the, on the job side and some of the data?
Yeah. The pattern basically to me looks like the S&P can push a little higher. Again, it's on the back of what's happening with the Qs, NVIDIA, the semiconductor stocks. So can the S&P trade to 5,400 to 5,440? Yes, I think that is likely. I think that will mark a high, at least an interim high, that will be followed by a 5-7% correction. And the nature of that correction will tell us a lot in terms of, okay, is there another shoe to drop, or will we get one more blast to the upside? And right now, to me, the main thing is there's more risk than a reward. I've been telling my subscribers that above 5,300, it's time to do some lightening. And other than the small mega cap stocks and NVIDIA, that's been good advice, because the majority of stocks have been declining over the last handful of weeks, unlike, obviously, the concentrated mega cap stocks.
All right, we're going to talk about the coming secular bear market on the other side of the break, but we do have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jim. Hey, be sure to subscribe, follow, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If that's an option for you, I've been told that's podcast gold. Totally appreciate the solid there. And as always, subscribe and turn on those notifications so you know when a new Gains episode drops. We drop Gains episodes on Wednesday mornings. We'll be right back after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. but I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy!
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and, for shoppers, buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Back with Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Give the Gains listener that special offer, Jim.
Jim Welsh Macro at Gmail. And I'll be happy to send out the June 10th issue of the MacroTides Weekly Technical Review.
All right, so we talked about kind of where the market is right now and how you see things and the potential weakness going forward. But then wanted to even extend the conversation. We've talked about this a while back, the potential coming of a secular bear market. And I want you to kind of explain that to the Gains listeners.
Okay. One thing I want to, I guess, address first. In 2022, Andy, and, you know, we had conversations. A lot of people were looking for a recession in 2022. I disagreed. Said there would not be a recession in 2022 or in 2023. So I haven't been a one-note Joni like, oh, my God, this guy's falling. I just think a lot of things are starting to come together that investors need to be aware of because risk levels, I think, are rising not just in the very short term, but potentially for the next 10 to 15 years. So one of the key aspects is treasury yields. And they move in big swings. So from 1945 to 1981, the 10-year treasury went from about 1.5% to 15.5%. So you had a 36-year secular bear market in treasury yields. And as we know, as yields kept marching up, the stock market entered its own secular bear market from 1966 to 1982. And the secular bear market in stocks didn't end until treasury yields peaked in 81 and really started to come down. And they continued to drop from 1981 until 2020. So you had a secular bull market in the treasury bond market, and that brought yields consistently down. And as we've seen, you know, lower treasury yields allow stock prices to be valued at a higher price earnings ratio. So the movement in treasury yields are very significant in terms of their impact on equity prices. So I have a special report, The Coming Secular Bear Market. One of the charts that's in there is looking at the 30-year treasury bond price from 1981 until now. And what you can see from 1981 until March of 2020, treasury bond prices would go up, pull back a little bit, make a higher high, pull back a little bit. So there was a trend line that the 30-year Treasury bond respected for that 39-year window. In 2022, Treasury bond prices fell dramatically. They broke that trend line. So that long-term secular bull market in bonds, I believe, has ended. We've begun a new secular bear market in Treasury yields. And what that implies is over the next 10 to 20 years, Treasury yields are going to gradually, but probably persistently, move higher. And that has implications for valuations in the equity market. So to me, that is one of the key aspects of why we need to be more careful, because the chart of Treasury bonds is giving a pretty negative signal. Not for the next 6 months. I've been bullish TLT. I think we just made a low. I think TLT and Treasury bond yields are going to come down over the next 3 to 6 months. I'm talking about, what happens beyond that and, multiple years beyond that.
You're talking about kind of a long-term fundamental shift in markets as we know it.
And two things. If we go back and look at the last 50 years or so, what has happened every time the economy has slowed? The federal government rolls out and increases deficit spending, through unemployment benefits and other various programs. The Federal Reserve cuts interest rates. But if we look at each of those factors, they have been weakening. So, what we've seen is, this last year, the deficit was over 6%, $1.7 trillion. GDP only grew 3%. So if you look at each new dollar of debt since the 1960s, Andy, has generated less and less GDP growth. So in the 1960s, it was about 90 cents for every dollar. Now we're down to about 35 cents. The point being is, in order to generate the same level of growth in the economy from 40, 50 years ago, we need more and more debt. And despite a huge debt increase last year, the response in terms of the economy's growth, 6% GDP deficit, 3% GDP growth. The other factor, monetary policy, going back 50, 60, 70 years, the Fed kept the funds rate positive, meaning that the federal funds rate was always above the CPI. So if the CPI was 2% and the funds rate was 4 to 5%, that meant the funds rate had a real rate of return. So the way the Fed ran policy, monetary policy, for decades was, all right, we want the economy to slow. They would increase the degree that the Fed funds rate was at a real rate. So in 1981, the funds rate had like a 6% real rate, which resulted in a fairly deep recession in 1982. However, since 2000, the funds rate has almost always been negative. We went for years with it at 1%. Then, years after the pandemic, we're at basically zero, with inflation at 2 and 3% and then up to 9. So my point is, the Federal Reserve used to be able to, if you will, manipulate the economy by changing the level of the real funds rate. Since 2020 or 2000, they haven't been able to do that. And after the financial crisis, they expanded the Fed's balance sheet from $700 billion to $4.5 trillion. And then in response to the pandemic, from about $4 trillion to $9 trillion. So again, to me, what that looks like, Andy, is monetary policy, much like the fiscal policy, you need more juice to get a weak response in the economy.
You're getting less bang for your buck, it seems like now. And then with all these numbers and everything, the bottom line that the Gaines listener wants to know is, what can you do?
Well, I think what it suggests is, when you're in a secular bull market, every dip is going to be, the lows are going to be higher and higher. The highs are going to be higher and higher. Basically, the trend is up. When you get to a secular bear market, that no longer works. So buying and holding during a secular bull market is the right strategy.
As they say, rising tides raise all boats. That's why, and it's really easy to invest in that kind of condition. Okay, so the other side of the coin, as you said.
Yeah, it is in a secular bear market. If you look at the 1966 to 82 time period, the Dow went from 1,000 in 66 to 630 in 1970, back to 1,000 in 73 to 574 in 74, back to 1,000, and finally in 1982 bottom just under 800. 16 years later, and a lot of inflation, and only then started a new secular bear market once the Fed cut rates and Treasury yields came down.
What was the play then during that time period? You know, you have huge swings and you didn't have any kind of breakout. And a lot of years, you know, pick up something, it'd move, and then the markets would come back down. I mean, we're first of all, were people making money? I mean, you always make money in the stock market, but I mean, how were people effectively playing that then? And does that translate to today?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, Wall Street has always told people just buy and hold because since 1928, the S&P goes up 9% a year or 10%, counting dividends. And that's great advice over 100 years. But if you're 45 or 50, and you go through a 15-year secular bear market, and you haven't seen your investment portfolio from the stock side grow, gee, you don't care about what's happened since 1928. You only care that, hey, 15 years have gone by, I'm that much older, and my assets haven't grown. So to me, what that implies, I'm not saying everybody should sell everything. No, that's way too dramatic. However, just in, like in the 60s and the 70s, a tactical approach. In other words, playing those big swings where the market goes down a lot, and then there's a policy response by the Fed and the government, and you get a big rally. And then another deep sell-off. So the only way to, I think, benefit, not just survive, but benefit, is using a tactical approach to the market. And, you know, that basically is the foundation of my approach. Is using a combination of fundamental and technical analysis, Andy.
And it seems like
you can get those swings.
And it seems like you'd have to be more of a stock picker. A lot of times you could pick sectors, just buy into indexes. It seems like, as you mentioned, you have to be a little more tactical here. And I guess that includes drilling in and being really sure of the individual companies you're buying as well.
Well, and also using chart analysis. I mean, again, you had some great companies, the Nifty 50 in the early 70s. You know, people, Nifty 50, you just buy these 50 stocks, you don't have to do anything, right? Well, a lot of those stocks were overpriced going into the 73, 74 bear market and lost 70 to 90% of their value. Great companies, you know, but valuations were overdone. And then because of the severity of that bear market, that got overdone in the other direction.
It makes me kind of think, are some of the great companies that we talk about today, NVIDIA, some of the real powerhouses, what you're talking about, we could maybe even see a similar setup for them as they've maybe stretched valuation. Explain.
Well, I'll go back to the 1920s, RCA. Your listeners should look it up, the history of RCA. In 1921, it was $6 a share. And then all of a sudden, the idea that RCA not only would have radio stations, but would broadcast images and that people could actually see people on a screen talking and hear their voice and see them, television. It was like, oh, my God, it's going to revolutionize the world. And the RCA stock, since they were at the core of this, went from $6 to $568 in 1929. Now, RCA became the National Broadcasting Company, NBC. So did they fulfill the, if you will, the dream of, boy, they're going to have TV stations all over the country, and they're going to, you know, we're going to be able to watch it, and they're going to have programming. Unbelievable. By 1932, the stock was $15. Now, obviously, that's the Depression overdone. At the same time, I think something similar will happen to NVIDIA. It's an unbelievable company. It's overpriced. If we look out the next 5 years to 10 years, it's overpriced. I, you know, technically, I can make a case. It will make its way back down towards $50 a share at some point in time. Okay. And again, it's not being too crazy. In the short run, can the stock continue to work its way? Of course. But those are the things that investors have to, I think, avoid, those mistakes. And even just your regular, everyday, great company, technical analysis can help you. If a stock is generating great results, but the major trend of the stock market is down, those stocks, even good companies, go down with the market. More than 50%, and this is to me what led me 40 years ago, Andy, I read this statistic, and it led me into paying attention to monetary policy and using technical analysis. More than half of any individual company's stock price is determined by market trend, not by the underlying fundamentals of the company itself.
Wow, that's really interesting. So there's a lot of other forces moving the price of stock well beyond the straight health and of the business and the company.
Yes. Yeah. And so to me, to be oblivious to that, again, that what shaped my approach to the stock market in terms of, okay, if the major trend of the market contributes more than 50% to the average stock price direction, then I want to learn about the things that influence the major trend. And they were primarily monetary policy, and then using technical analysis to quantify when trends were running out of gas. And of course, the biggest swings have occurred around pivot points with monetary policy. So monetary policy is really important.
But you certainly don't want to trust Wall Street's read on monetary policy, because talk about
And
we've talked about that. We never bought into any of this. I know I didn't, and I'm pretty sure you were too. We were talking, I mean, they were talking 6-7 weeks. This is insane. And talk about a misread of the Fed.
You're right.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, what you're touching on is at the end of the last year, Wall Street was looking for 6 rate cuts. And as you and I talked, it's like, that's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. It's one of the reasons why in late December, I thought we were going to see Treasury yields go up. I turned bullish in October of last year when the 10-year got up to about 5%. And in December, it was down under around 380, 385. And then, you know, the whole idea that the Fed is going to cut 6 times is ridiculous. We're going to see Treasury yields go up. And the 10-year went from 380 to 470 over the last 4 or 5 months. Now I think the odds are we're going to see Treasury yields drop. So Wall Street went from 6 cuts about a month ago. They were worried that the Fed, you know, right before the May 1st meeting, it was like, well, you know, 3 bad inflation reports, the Fed may actually hike rates. I thought that was ridiculous. There's no way the Fed was going to hike rates. So when Powell said, no, rate hike really isn't on the table, that's what led to the stock market rallying pretty strongly after that May 1st FOMC meeting. So this, you know, it's one of those things where one has to listen to what Wall Street is saying and then use some common sense. And when Wall Street is out to lunch, you have to be able to say, you know what, the idea of 6 rate cuts was ridiculous. Remember in 2022, in January, Chair Powell said inflation was a severe threat. Goldman Sachs said, well, we might get 3 rate hikes in 2022, a quarter point, three quarter point reason. I said the Fed's going to front load rate hikes, and they're going to raise in March, May, and June of 2022, which is exactly what the Fed did. So the idea that Wall Street has a corner on knowledge is wrong. You know, they get it right sometimes. I'm not trying to say blanket wrong. But that's when one has to use common sense. I heard Powell say severe threat, and I'm thinking, okay, if I'm confronted with a severe threat, what do I do? Do I react nonchalantly or do I react aggressively? Well, I react aggressively. And I assumed the Fed would do the same, and they did. So the point, going back to the original supposition here, is that the secular bear market that I believe began in the Treasury bond market is really important in terms of stock market valuation. And one of the factors that I think is going to play into this, Andy, is if the economy slows as I expect, the Fed will at some point cut rates, and we will see Treasury yields come down. But the other thing is going to happen is the government will spend even more money. So instead of a $1.7 trillion deficit, it will be $3 trillion or more. That's an enormous amount of paper for the bond market to absorb. And I think one of the drivers of why we could see Treasury yields move up over the next 5 to 10 years is we have no fiscal discipline in this country. Zero. Neither party has any fiscal discipline. And the net result is I don't see a real solution anywhere, anytime soon, addressing that problem, which means just more and more deficits, more and more paper that has to be sold. I think that'll equate to higher Treasury yields until something breaks.
Big thanks to Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, real quick, we covered a lot of ground, but share with the Gains listeners how they can get your Macro Tides report.
Jim Welsh, W-E-L-S-H, macro at Gmail.
Hey, be sure to subscribe, follow, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if that's an option for you. And as always, subscribe and turn on those notifications so you know when a new Gains episode drops. We drop Gains episodes on Wednesday mornings, and I look forward to seeing you then.
A News Radio WBBM podcast powered by Odyssey.